Welcome to the fourth episode of Season 3 of the Ubuntu UK podcast. It's Monday the 29th of March 2010, and in this episode we're going to talk to Simon Phipps about his new role at the Open Source Institute. We'll have a command line love, and we will course over the latest news, events, a bit about Ubuntu, and your feedback. I'm Alan. I'm having a bad evening. With me this week is Laura.
To make it worse. Hi.
Hello.
Hang on.
Sorry. Yeah. I say hello to Laura.
Hello, Tony.
Hello.
Get a room. Hello, Laura.
Hello, Alan.
How are you?
I'm fine, thank you.
What have you been up to?
A surprising amount of blogging.
Really?
Yeah.
What, a blog post?
No, three blog posts in 1 month.
Oh, my life.
Wow.
So, and this one of them, I caught my wife reading last night.
She liked it on Facebook.
Well, when I say caught.
it wasn't that bad.
It wasn't illicit or anything.
Well.
No, it was about the...
It was my Ada Lovelace day, wasn't it?
No, it was the thing you're wearing right now.
Ah, my jumper.
Yes.
Ah, because she liked my Ada Lovelace one as well.
Ah, okay.
Yeah.
You got a fan.
Uh-huh.
Excellent.
Yeah, and the other one was geeky.
So one crochet, one geeky.
Yeah, that was on installing IBM software on Ubuntu when it's not support, well, unsupported software, and how to do it.
Cool.
Which is quite cool.
Was that mainly aimed at your other IBM types?
Mostly, yes, and helped by them on Twitter as well.
Ah, okay, cool. We've also got Tony. Hello.
Hi.
Tony.
Hello. That was me talking earlier.
Hello.
What have you been up to?
Not a huge amount. I know what I did. I made a poster in Inkscape. I had to do a poster as part of my coursework for the course I'm doing, and I did it all in Inkscape, which is sort of the first major thing I really had to do in it. So I was using that.
Is Inkscape the right thing for doing posters?
It was the thing that occurred to me to use, mainly because I knew I wanted to use some elements from SVG, other SVG files, things like Open Clip Art. So I took a couple of things from that, incorporated them into my design, and it was good. It worked. I passed.
Excellent.
Well, which is the important thing.
And Simon.
Hello. I'm back.
Hey. Yes.
Yay.
I was at the theatre last time. I'm sorry about that.
You're trying to sound all cultured now, when we just said you were just not here. You got
a bluff.
Reinforce the fact that actually I was at the theatre, don't you know?
Sorry, I was at the cinema.
Well done.
When I'm not here, I'm stuck in traffic.
Or a snowdrift.
What have you been up
to?
Actually, not too much until this last week gone. I'm a radio ham, don't you know?
Mm.
But I haven't been on the air for years. Everything else has been sort of taken over. However,
been packed away.
It's all been packed away. All the radios are in a box in the roof. Can't be bothered. Too many cables. And it really does get in the way. However, Joey Stanford blogged last week about, come on, all you hams, we need to get hold of all of the amateur radio software in Ubuntu and give it some love.
Yeah.
And I thought, Now, I'm heavily into satellites. And there's some satellite software within Ubuntu. And it definitely needs some love.
And you're the man to give it that love.
I'm hoping to be. Yeah, I've been doing a lot of searching, digging, and sort of detective work as to how I might help out. And that's looking good. Actually.
You should tell us about that in far more depth at a later date.
Probably. Once you've had a bit of a play. Shut up, Simon.
No. That was not.
It
but
felt like it.
I think, we could really go into some details about that. Because the only thing I know about radio hams is that Tony Hancock episode
from
the 60s.
So no, I think, no. Cool. This is really good
stuff.
Okay. So cute. the only other thing, of course, is, and I'm not going to steal your thunder, I hope, but Ubuntu One Music Store is the other big thing.
Oh, you've been playing with that?
Yeah.
You've been buying music?
Yeah.
Excellent.
After I'd started off straight away, I'd been in it about a minute and found a bug.
Good.
Which has been fixed.
Well, that's already better than finding it after it's released.
Which is good.
And that's now available for everybody can take part in that beta.
Everyone running Lucid.
Everyone Lucid.
And it's definitely worth it.
Good. Cool.
Now, last time we said we were going to introduce ourselves each episode, and this time it's Alan's turn. Alan, I know the time has just said we run out of time, but you don't escape that easily. So tell us a little bit about who you are, why you're sitting here in our front room.
I wasn't prepared for this, even though it says my name in the thing.
I did that.
Oh,
I didn't draw your attention to it. I thought he'd catch you on the hop.
Thanks. So I'm someone who uses Linux. and I'm not a programmer, and mm-hmm. I'm not especially super competent system administrator either. I'm really just a user, and I talk about it a lot and blog about it a bit, and I know a bit about how to use the desktop, a little bit about how to use a server, and I came to be in your living room through Hampshire Lug, I guess, originally. Mm-hmm. We met at a Lug meeting that I brought my 8-month pregnant wife to.
Yes.
It was her first Lug meeting and last, funny enough. But yeah, I met you guys and then became friends, and then we decided to do a podcast, and that's why I'm here.
So how can people find you on the internet?
They can find me by typing Popey into whatever their search engine is, and they'll probably find it. And that's Popey, P-O-P-E-Y.
Yes, not Popeye, not the X-ray. No, or anything like that, no, or extra O's.
No particular fancy for olive oil at all.
Right, okay. Excellent, okay. Well, let's get on with it.
There's no Dave here to say it sounds like a fun-packed show, I'm afraid.
So it's not going to be fun-packed.
No. In the news this week...
The Creative Commons music store Magnatune has found the unlimited downloads membership scheme introduced 2 years ago so popular that it's moving away from shipping CDs and users paying per album.
What does that mean?
Basically, you have a subscription membership which you can download as many tracks and albums and things as you like.
Oh.
They used to be able to ship CDs with music on it, but they decided that actually people were just downloading FLAC and WAV versions and making their own, which is understandable.
Yeah.
And they used to be able to do pay a certain amount per album. Now, you can still do that, but it's going to cost you $12 per album. So essentially, they're wanting people to kind of not do that anymore.
Right.
So there you go. Different change in model.
And how much is it a month?
I don't know.
Oh, okay.
A few bucks.
Hot on the heels of the announcement that open source Nouveau driver is making its way into the Linux kernel proper, comes the news that NVIDIA has dropped support for their open source driver. NVIDIA recommend the binary only driver instead.
Yeah, it's quite funny this. The way they frame it is the NV driver is what people use to get going with Linux, and then they all migrate to the fantastic NVIDIA binary driver. That's the way it's framed, and we now recommend that you use the Visa driver to install your Linux operating system and then go to the NVIDIA binary driver. It's framed as if we know the NV driver is rubbish, but they're only there to get you up and running, and then you install the binary driver.
Because people love the binary goodness.
Well, they do if they want to get 3D, at the moment, sadly.
The CIO of American CNL Bank has suggested that users of its online banking service would be more secure using Ubuntu and Firefox than the family PC running Windows. They are even considering dishing out customized bootable CDs from branches.
That's pretty cool.
That is really cool. When I saw it, I was, wow, that's kind of thinking outside the box, really, isn't it?
And it also says something about Windows. If a banking system says to their customers, you know, what you're using is really unsafe. You really should not be using that. You should be using this other thing instead. I mean, they do talk about, being the family computer.
So. I assume they're sort of saying that even an Ubuntu CD distributed a few months ago with potentially any Firefox vulnerabilities in it is still more secure than Windows. Yes. Right, fair enough.
Well, they're on about making their own distribution, surely.
I think it's Ubuntu with tweaks, so they were going to set it as the bank's
homepage, and then blocks every other bank and transfers all the money out of that bank and into this bank.
I know, I read it, they were going to actually make their own distro, take everything off apart from what you need to bank
the browser.
With. So when you want to go and do your online banking, sling the CD in, reboot, do your banking, power down, take it out, and crack on with your silly little Windows box.
Like a kiosk.
Yeah, essentially.
The internet video service Thing, Miro, have released version 3.0, promising to be faster, smoother, and louder. The project also announced a new easy-to-use video converter for people baffled with the settings in every other video converter out there.
Yes, it's a front-end to FFmpeg and all the other usual tools.
But the video converter.
The video converter is, yeah. So it's the same sort of things underneath, but if it's easy to use and presumably hides a lot of the settings away, then fair enough.
Yeah, absolutely. And Miro itself has always been given a bit of a kicking for being slow to start.
That's one of the things they've got like a 50% increase in startup speed or something, they say.
Increase in startup speed?
decrease in startup speed, I suppose.
Yes.
So straight on to the events. The Southeast Linux Fest.
Is still on?
Yeah, indeed. Still June 11th, 12th and 13th. And we've got the promo to play
again. We've played already.
Twice, but anyway, let's play it again. It's good.
Join us for the 2010 Southeast Linux Fest as we once again celebrate Linux and open source software in the GNU/South. Due to the overwhelming response last year, this year's event will be bigger, better, and longer. Stealth 2010 will take place Friday, June 11th through Sunday, June 13th at the Spartanburg Marriott at Renaissance Park in Spartanburg, South Carolina. Be there for UbuCon, Fedora Activity Day, BSDA certification, Drupal Camp, multiple parties featuring Dual Core as well as the guys from Mystery Science Theater 3000 as Rift Tracks, and an even more expansive group of superb speakers, sponsors, and exhibitors. Stealth is free to attend, but hurry and register today to lock in the special discount room rate at the hotel. Register today at southeastlinuxfest.org.
See, I said it was good.
EuroPython is July 19th to the 24th in Birmingham, UK. You can find out more details at europython.eu.
The third OSBar camp is coming up on April the 17th and is being held at IBM's Pembroke Street offices in Dublin. A biennial event to promote open source, OSBar camp is held in an unconference style with a broad range of talks and events covering the open source technology landscape, ranging from in-depth technical tutorials to project updates right on to introductory aspects of open source. The broad elements of the open source community will be on display. Find out more at osbarcamp.org. And that's being run by Laura Tchaikovsky, who's helping us run OSBarCamp.
And hey, it must be fantastic then.
Must be fantastic.
We're just 4.5 weeks away from OSBarCamp, and we're yet again teaming up with the Linux Outlaws to host a weekend of open source fun and frolics. And we're going to have a live recording of the podcast on Sunday.
Yeah. Excellent idea.
And Fab's set up a fantastic site where you can offer talks and put up suggestions for things you'd like to see or hear at the event, or even during the actual podcast recording on the Sunday.
Get along, ideas.ogcamp.org.
Yeah, it's good. There's
some
already
great ideas.
Yeah, yeah, it's already a list of people who want to give a talk there.
Yeah, or would like to see something given. It's basically ideas.ogcamp.org is a wiki, basically.
Yeah, it's an open wiki.
Open wiki. Go along there and stick your ideas on. Some interesting ones there already. One about the election and who geeks should be voting for, or at least the different views of different parties. I think Alan Bell from Talk.
Yep. The Open Learning Centre.
That's the one.
That'll be lovely and topical by then.
Yeah, yeah, as we say.
Yeah, one week before the election.
Absolutely.
About 4 days or something, wasn't it?
Good Lord, yeah.
So come on then. If you've never been to anything like this before, why should you go?
Because there'll be plenty of people there who are probably like-minded, and also people there who are completely different-minded from you, but you might learn some interesting, cool things from them.
My mum and dad are going to come.
Oh, my life. Brilliant.
Yeah.
What are they going to talk about?
I have no idea, but they're going to come. They've worked out a way of getting into Liverpool and parking and everything special.
I hope they've got
I haven't even done that.
I know.
Why am I not surprised? I hope they've got some embarrassing baby photos of you or something they're going
to
bring along.
I'll have to tell them to sort out a presentation.
Yeah. Mm. Of course, you don't have to do a presentation. No. You can just come along and take part. But the idea is you can get involved and help shape the event and make it what you want it to be.
One of the interesting ways of getting involved, and this is how I got into Log Radio, actually, is to volunteer for the crew. Even if you don't know anybody, it's absolutely the best way to get involved.
Yeah. Definitely.
Because you will most certainly become part of the team and get right into the guts of the whole org camp. So if you're on your own, volunteer for the crew.
Yeah, definitely.
They were a good bunch last year.
Yeah.
Couldn't have done it without them. Yeah. We just sat back and let them organise it, and we just stood up. You know,
just stood up, mouth watching everything.
And we've got a great head of crew this year who's organising them all, so they'll be even more militarily organised than last time.
Anna will knock everyone into shape.
She will. I wouldn't argue with her. No. So if you're interested in getting involved in being on the crew, you can email ogcamp@ubuntu-uk.org. And there will be some as yet to be confirmed perks.
Yeah, I have no idea what that is.
We haven't really sorted
it out. It's not like we know what the perks are, and told you. We don't know what they are.
I should imagine they'll be in the lines of mugs or t-shirts or something like that. But,
You can also join us in the #ogcamp IRC channel on the Freenode network. We all tend to lurk in there.
Indeed. We have had a few people say, oh, I've had difficulty getting a hotel. Well, there are still plenty of hotels available. Dan has updated the ogcamper.org website with details of where you can find hotel rooms for, say, the 3 days if you're coming up on the Friday, so 3 nights. So, yeah, don't let that stop you coming up there. There's some cheap deals as well.
And you don't have to come up for all 3 days. If you're only available on the Sunday or only on the Saturday, then come for either one.
Absolutely.
And don't forget also we've got the... concert, not really a concert.
Rat Hole Radio Show. Sorry, Rat Hole Road Show.
It's a gig.
Yes. It's a,
yeah,
gig.
A gig. Concert. I'm sounding really old and farty.
Like
now,
Simon going to the theatre.
I'm trying, but it's not working, is it?
With some very kind of free culture-y people in. Attila the Stockbroker is the one that springs to my mind.
Yep, and that you do have to buy a ticket
there
for.
There are tickets for that, yeah. I think they're about £5. But
mine arrived the other day.
Really? Excellent.
Yeah, with a little personalised note from Dan.
Yes.
It was really sweet.
So did mine. You can find out more about that on ogcamp.org as well.
And there'll be some kind of party or something happening on the Saturday night.
Yep. Will
and
there?
I'm sure there'll be people around to have a drink and chat to and things on the Sunday. So if you are only there for 1 day, you'll still get to chat to people.
It's on the 1st and 2nd of May 2010. We haven't mentioned that. And it is at the Black E in Liverpool. So that's where we're headed. We have some sponsors who make it all possible. Basically, they pay the bills. So we need to give them a good mention. Who have we got?
Linux Format, who are our media partner again and have done us a fantastic ad in this latest issue of Linux Format, so go out and buy it.
Absolutely.
It is. I'm holding it in my hand right now.
And they've also put a subscription offer up on our website.
Yes, you can get a really good discount on that. It's worth
so if you go to the front page of our website...
It is worth subscribing again just to get a discount.
Yep, so they're our media partner. Who else have we got, Laura?
We've got the Open Learning Centre and Linux Emporium, OpsView, Bitfolk, and a new sponsor who's Recruit 12.
Excellent. Okay. Well, you can find the Facebook group where you can declare you're coming along to the event if you're a Facebook user, and all the other details at ogcamp.org, and we will see you there.
We're very pleased to have in the studio Simon Phipps, ex-son and now OSI, one of the OSI directors. Welcome, Simon.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here so far from home.
We should start off basically with an introduction for those people who don't know who you are, who I don't know who these people could be. Who are you and why should we care?
I'm just this local guy in Southampton.
You
obviously had a down evening and needed a local guy. So, as you say, I've just finished... 5 years as the chief open source officer at Sun Microsystems. In that time, I presided over the liberation of Unix, of the Java platform, of the Java server platform, of the Spark chip designs, of... what else? Well, pretty much everything, actually. and I feel very gratified to see that all of that code is free software, and it doesn't matter what change of strategy there might be in the company that follows on from Sun, because all of the software freedoms are guaranteed in the steps that we took.
And some open source acquisitions as well, things like MySQL, VirtualBox.
Yeah, so we acquired, the first one that we acquired actually was StarDivision. So we acquired OpenOffice.org and liberated that. Then we also acquired NetBeans and liberated that, created a free ID out of that. A number of other companies, VirtualBox, and then MySQL was the last one in the line there.
And so fairly recently you've moved on from Sun Microsystems and now you're doing other interesting things.
Right. So at the moment I'm making sure that I go down to St. Cross House down in Southampton every 2 weeks and sign on. And to fill the time in between sign-ons, I've been elected as a member of the board of directors for the Open Source Initiative. So I'm one of 10 directors there. I'm the new kid on the block, along with a gentleman from Brazil and with Tony Wasserman, who runs Carnegie Mellon West over in California.
And so what do the OSI do and why should we care about them?
So OSI was founded in 1999. By a group of people who had just had experience of Netscape going out of business and having to do something with its web browser, and they created the Mozilla Foundation out of that. That whole experience of persuading the executives at Netscape that they wanted to liberate their software persuaded a bunch of people over on the west coast of the US that there needed to be a new approach to explaining free software to business people. Because when you went to people like the executives at Netscape, if you led on an argument about software freedom, they would typically look you in the eye and decide that you were a crackpot.
Because of the word free?
Not just because of the word free, but because you had led on something that was about personal freedom rather than led on something that was about business value.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So this group of people realized that all of the things that made Netscape want to open source Mozilla were business factors that derived from software freedom. And so they decided that it would be better, rather than leading with software freedom as the idea, to lead with the benefits that you get from software freedom.
Right.
And so the open source ideal and the open source initiative is like it's kind of like a shadowgram. You know, you hold your hands up to the light bulb and you see the picture on the wall. And OSI is the shadow on the wall from software freedom in the spotlight. And that ideal of putting software freedom ideas into practical, pragmatic form that business leaders can adopt because they have business value has proven to be a brilliant move, because today open source has won. You know, every software business out there has got open source somewhere in their business strategy, in most cases somewhere near the middle of their business strategy. And OSI is the group of people that are the stewards of the open source definition that says what an open source license looks like, and of the open source service mark, which is the little green open O that people use to represent their open source credentials.
And people seem to be using that term open source quite a lot, and it seems it comes up for a bit of abuse.
Well, the thing about open source as a term is that because it is such a strong brand, because it has such strong associations to people, lots of people have tried to appropriate it. Mm. So lots of corporations, for example, have described themselves as open source when in actual fact they don't have software freedom as their priority. One of the things the OSI board has to do at regular intervals is say to people, you're not open source because, well, look, you don't actually comply with these clauses in the open source definition.
Is there anything that could actually stop them from saying they're open source?
On the whole, what will stop people saying they're open source is the reason that they want to describe themselves as open source is because they know that a whole lot of community energy comes from doing that.
Yeah.
What OSI does is it mobilizes the community to reject the abuse of the term. So there isn't a direct causality. It's not that OSI can say we're going to sue you, but OSI can say, well, I'm sorry, but the way you're using open source there is not right. And the OSI board asserts that you should not be calling your product open source. And in every case that we've done that so far, the company involved has backed down.
So would the OSI actually go as far as telling people don't get involved with this product or this company or the community around it?
I think we would have to be, because OSI is a California corporation and they have laws over there that that we haven't quite got here yet, although we will have soon. We have to be very cautious about taking that sort of action. But we can state facts clearly. We can state that although company ABC says that their product is open source, its license does not actually comply with the open source definition, and OSI would not have authorized it had it been asked for an opinion. So that's about as far as we'd go. We probably wouldn't engage in a verbal attack, because when you do that, you are inviting litigation, and they've got lots more money than we have.
Fair enough.
And I don't think I'm alone in noticing there's been a bit of an upsurge in discussion around the OSI, probably mostly since you've become one of the directors. Does that mean there's been not a lot of activity over the past few years and now it's ramping up? Or is there some change in the way the OSI is working? What's changing in the OSI now?
So, well, it isn't just about me joining. What's been happening at OSI is that there has been a hiatus in its activity over the middle of the decade. And the OSI board members have realized that the future of the OSI does need securing. OSI, although it gets denounced fairly frequently by some parts of our community, ISI plays a really important role in free software because a lot of procuring organizations, such as governments and big corporations, reference the open source definition as their benchmark for what free software is. And because of that, the stewardship of the open source definition is a crucial element in free software going forward into the future. If we want to secure software freedom, we have to make sure that OSI doesn't become derelict. Mm. So those of us who are on the board at the moment believe that it's very important to build a secure future for OSI. One of the initiatives that we've got going is an attempt to work out how to make OSI be a member organization. Up until now, it's been a kind of an oligarchy. It's been a board that elects its successors.
Mm-hmm.
I, for one, am very keen to turn OSI into an organization where the board is elected by people who are passionate about free software around the world. So I'd like to see Linux user groups and BSD user groups and software groups around the world affiliate with OSI and be in a relationship where their members could then become electors of the board, so that the future of OSI is anchored not on our luck at recruiting board members, but rather on a very broad base of people who understand what software freedom is about.
And the details of that haven't been worked out yet, but I guess...
So we're a reasonable way down the road in our discussions on the board, and the next step is going to be to crystallize that discussion into a proposed membership scheme, and then we will go public with that and encourage public debate about it.
But are you definitely looking at group memberships rather than individual memberships?
We're actually looking at group memberships and individual memberships.
Oh, okay.
Because there are a lot of people who would like to be OSI members. We get an email on the board mailing address. osi@opensource.org gets email pretty much every day from people wanting to be members. And we don't have any way for them to be members at the moment.
Right.
So one of the things we will do is create an individual membership scheme. But also, open source is very important to a lot of community groups. It's also very important to a lot of corporations.
Mm.
So we may well have a class of membership that allows corporations to become members of OSI. But we're very, very wary indeed about selling influence like that.
Yeah.
We want to be able to hear their voice, but we want them to realize that software freedom is the thing that matters, not business success with open source.
Speaking of corporations, there was recently an announcement put out by yourselves about or taking aim at the BBC relating to some DRM that they're planning on implementing. Can you tell us a little bit about what the OSI stand on that and what that's all about?
Right, I can. So the BBC are encouraging they're requesting Ofcom in the UK to permit them to put a broadcast flag on BBC digital broadcasts, so that only devices that can verifiably handle that broadcast flag are able to view the digital broadcasts. This is just the idea that was shouted down in America, being brought back out of hiding again, and implemented in the UK. It's just as bad an idea over here as it was there.
And the driver is to restrict what you can do with content that's delivered to your home.
Absolutely. So the idea is that you won't be able to use your Freeview box if the manufacturer hasn't subscribed to the rules of how you handle the broadcast flag. And then what the BBC is proposing doing is putting the management of that those rules out to an organisation that's actually outside the UK that will govern the rules for who can have which broadcast bit set in which flag and what you can do with it. So the BBC is proposing two really bad things. One of them, they're proposing to make sure that you have to respect the broadcast flag on digital broadcasts. And that's death to Myth TV.
Mm-hmm.
That means that no more ability for free software to be used in devices that interpret TV broadcasts.
Unless we ignore the broadcast flag?
Well, won't be able to, because the signal will be encrypted. And the only way you'll be able to decrypt it will be if you're party to the secret. And you'll only be able to be party to the secret if you promise in a sueable way to respect the broadcast flag.
Mm.
So the first bad thing is the DRM, and the second bad thing is putting all of the rules of the management of that in the hands of people who have no accountability to the license payer.
And the OSI have spoken out against this.
So OSI, with many other organisations, so if you go look at the letter, Open Rights Group has got a page about this, they've put a position paper up. OSI signed up alongside the Electronic Frontier Foundation. We've stood shoulder to shoulder with the Free Software Foundation, with Quadrature du Net in France have signed up to it. And you'll see there's a whole list of organisations there, because we believe that the erosion of software freedom anywhere in the world is harmful. But the erosion of software freedom in this specific case is very bad, because the BBC's content is respected and consumed throughout the world. And if the BBC start demanding DRM, then it will naturally follow. Even in places like the US that have rejected the broadcast flag, you can see the inexorable consequence will be DRM there as well. So we believe it's really important to stand up and say, no, we don't want this to happen. And we have a very narrow window of opportunity to talk about it. Really, if anyone wants to do anything about this, they've got to do it before Easter. They need to write to Ofcom and express their views in their own words about why they do not want to see that DRM there. There's instructions up on the Open Rights Group's website.
So presumably this is not just a case of waiting for another DVD John type character to come along and crack this encryption. It's going to be tougher to do than that. And all the time it hasn't happened, we won't be able to watch TV on our myth boxes.
Well, that's the practical consequence. But much more sinister is this is part of a whole fabric of legislation.
Right.
So at the moment, you would probably be able to have a DVD John's type person reverse engineer the algorithm, hack or crack the key, and get everyone watching TV again for a few weeks before the offshore organization changes, moves all the bits around so you can't do it anymore. But before long, we're going to see the anti-counterfeiting trade agreement, this secretive agreement that's being negotiated outside the visibility and scope of any of our democratic processes, putting a mandate in place to make that sort of activity illegal in every country in Europe. And so there won't be anywhere for DVD John to live, because he won't be able to live in America because of DMCA.
Mm.
Won't be able to live in Europe because of what ACTA has forced every member country to instantiate. And so what we'll see will be a chilling effect on software freedom, which will be that although we may all believe in it, most of us will not want to have the digital Stasi waiting at the door for us every time we go out. And it's quite real, that digital Stasi. You know, they will pick you up at Heathrow and lock you up. Or you'll go on holiday to over to the US and you'll find that you'll hear the snap of rubber gloves as you go through JFK.
But not in a nice way.
Not in a nice way.
Do you think it's a real... a realistic proposition that people will just find it too scary or too hard or too risky to get involved in open source and think, oh, I'll just go and buy Windows and buy macOS and stick Office on it?
Well, I think there's two dynamics there. One of them is the sort of seductive dynamic of the Mac operating system. I've raised my hand. You know, I've got Macs at home. And the reason I have Macs at home is because my family have found they work.
Mm.
And there are many people around the world who would rather have a working computer than freedom and a non-working computer.
Mm.
There's that dimension. The other dimension is indeed the dimension that says, well, you know, I could get that Linux operating system, but if I do, I won't be able to watch DVDs, I won't be able to listen to music, I won't be able to watch TV, I won't be able to use any of the websites that have news and views and media and downloads. Why would I want to live like that? I'll just go and get a copy of Windows. It sucks. You know, at least I'll be able to watch TV. And there's lots of people who'll take that view.
Yeah.
And I think that our ability as a software freedom community will gradually be eroded. So it's really important that people take action about this in the near future, because we have three attacks on our liberties coming up. Specifically in the UK, we've got this DRM on the BBC broadcasts.
Mm.
The second one is the Digital Economy Bill, which is being brushed through Parliament in a disgraceful way at the moment. And then the reason these things are all happening is they're the fruiting bodies. You know, you go out and you see the fairy circle on the lawn with the mushrooms all around it.
Mm.
And after a while, you realize that the reason all the mushrooms are in a circle is in the middle of the circle, there is a filthy great fungus. And you can't see the fungus, you can just see the mushrooms. The mushrooms are the fruiting bodies, and the fungus is hidden and growing in the dark. Well, Digital Economy Bill is the fruiting body for ACTA. ACTA is a dark fungus growing in secret, and we'll see more legislation coming from it, because it's going to bring in border seizures of equipment. It's going to bring in ISPs being required to filter content. It's going to bring in a DMCA-like rule preventing circumvention measures. They're all going to arise from ACTA.
What are the specifics that we should be concerned about in the UK? We'll come to ACTA in a minute, but what are the specifics of, because that's, you know, very immediate for us.
So the Digital Economy Bill, people are focused on the download rules. You know, the idea that if you download things you shouldn't have done too many times, you'll get cut off from the internet.
Mm. The so-called three strikes.
Three strikes or graduated response, depending on how emotive you're feeling. And I'm very happy to call that a really bad idea, because I think it's entirely disproportionate to disconnect a citizen from what is becoming the means of democracy simply because an allegation has been made against their children.
So that's one of the issues, is some would argue, well, these people who, you know, hog the bandwidth and who illegally share copyrighted content or stuff they're not licensed to share, shouldn't they be disconnected? Shouldn't something be done about these people who are, you know, nefarious in some way?
Probably should be.
And is this not an appropriate tool to do that?
No, it's not.
And why is that?
It's all about proportionality. It's the view that you should disconnect people for unauthorized downloads comes from a set of misthinking about copyright ownership. You can see that the framers of the Digital Economy Bill have been very heavily influenced by lobbyists from places like the BPI, the British Phonographic Institute, and other media organizations, into believing that people who do unauthorized downloads, first of all, are guilty when accused. Mm-hmm. Secondly, are always bad people. And thirdly, that the only reason to be on the internet is to do these things. Okay, mm-hmm. So the Digital Economy Bill has got this mindset that says the only reason people get on the internet is to use rich media, and if you abuse it, you should be cut off.
Right.
Now, if that is your worldview, then that's probably fair. But the truth is that just last week, Gordon Brown invested £30 million in a new web science institute at Southampton University, just down the road from here. And the reason he did that was because he said that every citizen should have high-speed broadband and had a right to be on the internet so they could participate in democracy. So with his right hand, he's encouraging every citizen to be connected to digital democracy. And with his left hand, he's saying that your democratic rights are only worth as much as an MP3 download. Mm. And that's the issue there. It's a matter of it's not saying that it's great that people download things that they shouldn't. I despise the idea that people should download things that they should have paid money for. It's not actually theft, but it isn't honest. Mm. Then to say, and as a result of you doing that, you should no longer have the ability to pay your taxes online, you should no longer be able to retax your car, you shouldn't be able to register for unemployment benefit, you shouldn't be able to check the electoral register, you shouldn't be able to get council services, you shouldn't be able to pay your credit card bills, do your banking, you shouldn't be able to join in with the Open University. You know, it's just disproportionate to disconnect people for something which is a civil matter between a media rights holder and an individual. Mm. There should be something done about it, but not this.
Right.
Isn't that the key, though, the fact that it is a civil matter? I mean, if I drive my car and I do something wrong four times, I get caught speeding or whatever, I lose the ability to drive my car. It still doesn't stop me going to those places. I just have to find other ways of getting there. If I would have my internet disconnected, I still could pay my credit card bill, but I'd have to do it by post.
Well, but this is more than that. This is like you were caught speeding three times in your car, and now your wife and your family are unable to drive as well.
Hmm.
Because they took your car away, and they've made sure that no one in your family can drive now. And by the way, they didn't actually take you to court. They just said they thought that they saw you speeding.
Yeah.
Mm. This is the difficulty in discussing it, is there is a clear moral case to make that there's bad things happening, but people then instantly jump to a conclusion that isn't justified by the evidence. Mm. But that actually is not the problem with the Digital Economy Bill. The problem with the Digital Economy Bill is that it creates a set of rules that give special privileges to a set of business models that date from the 20th century rather than from the future. And I don't believe that our elected representatives have had time to actually consider whether it's right to be doing that, because the bill has only been discussed in the House of Lords. The people who've discussed it clearly didn't know what they were looking at, if you look at the amendments they made.
Mm.
And there's now been no full debate in the House of Commons. There's been no committee stage. What's going to happen is that on the day after Easter Monday, on April the 6th, it's going to go for a second reading in the House. And chances are that Gordon Brown is going to announce the election that day. And what will immediately happen is the Digital Economy Bill will be pushed into the wash-up process, where instead of being debated, its acceptance is discussed in secret by the front bench spokespeople. And I believe that what's gone on here is actually intentional. You know, I believe that Lord Mandelson, the Divine Peter, has intentionally put this bill at this stage in the life of Parliament so that there can be the minimum scrutiny of the measures, because he doesn't want MPs to get educated about it.
Is it because there are technically difficult bits in it that makes it hard for MPs to scrutinise it properly?
Or absolutely.
Are they just, you know, complacent and they do this with everyone?
Well, it's not they're complacent. It's that MPs have to look at a lot of issues. So, you know, take Southampton again. You know, my local MP is Alan Whitehead. Alan is very strong on environmental issues, and he's got a lot of knowledge about environmental issues. He's got a good academic background. He used to be a professor at the Institute. He's not stupid. He's not bad. But he's not an expert on digital matters. But he's my representative.
Mm.
So what he and other MPs like him do is they say to the civil service, tell me what I should think and justify it. And the civil service builds a case. If it's an industry case, they'll often go to industry lobbyists who will say to them, here's how you should put it.
Mm.
And if you look at the Digital Economy Bill, the truth about it is that it's really bad advice for MPs, because it's been influenced almost exclusively by people who want to pay Cliff Richard's pension rather than by people who want to guarantee that free software advocates are able to continue to change the world, or that the future entrepreneurs with new business models are able to have successful businesses. And MPs need to have explained to them that it's not about letting naughty kids download MP3 files, that it is about having proper scrutiny for legislation which, just like the DMCA in America, will be abused to prop up businesses that ought to be going out of business but aren't, because the law has given them an extra leg up.
Mm.
And we mustn't allow our MPs to just let the bill be chewed through and wash up. I think we really need people to write to their MPs about it in the next few days.
And what's the best way? What's the best thing for them to do? Is there some easy mechanism for, you know, letting your MP know what should we be telling them?
Right. Well, we're very lucky in the UK. We've got a website called writetothem.com, and if you visit writetothem.com, you type your postcode into a box on the page, it finds out who your MP is, and it knows his email address or his fax machine number or his postal address and what he responds to, because they gather statistics from the results. And you type your letter into the webpage, click the button. They send you an email to validate that it's really you, and then they send the communication to the MP for you. It gets there within a few minutes, and for the more switched-on MPs, you get a reply straight back. For the less switched-on ones, like, unfortunately, my MP, it takes about 10 to 11 days to get a paper reply back through the mail.
Mm-hmm.
But you really can get straight to your MP and tell them the things you want them to know. You don't have to write a great big long learned diatribe about all this. You don't have to write an essay. You really can just write a message that says, I'm very concerned that the Digital Economy Bill is going to have a big impact on Britain's future innovation and competitiveness, and I believe there should be a full debate in the House of Parliament. Please will you make sure that happens? Signed me. That's all you have to say. Now, you can put a full case in if you want to. The longer you make the letter, the more likely it is that you'll get a form reply from your MP, because they won't read past the first paragraph, and they'll just send you the letter that they send to all the people who are saying that pirates should be allowed to download videos.
Right.
Hmm. So is it worth really customising the letter, or should you just use a form? Because there are form letters out there that people like 38 Degrees campaign are asking you to send to MPs on this sort of thing.
So the benefit of the 38 Degrees campaign, and you know, maybe we should put up some links for people
we'll do
to use. I'll certainly put up a posting on my blog afterwards. I'm on webmink.com. 38 Degrees has got the advantage that they keep statistics on how many people have responded to their campaigns. It has the disadvantage that it encourages you to use the same words everybody else does.
Yeah.
And it doesn't send you a copy of the letter. Mm. WriteToThem.com is fantastic. They send you a copy of the letter. They follow up about 2 weeks later with an email to ask you if your MP responded, so they can get gather statistics on which MPs are being responsive and how fast they are. I would say that if you've got the ability to be articulate, use WriteToThem.com. If really it's just that bit too much effort, please do use the 38 Degrees site and send one of their standard emails. It has less impact because what happens is the MPs just make a stack of all the ones that say the same things and say, Hey, look, there's 100 people here who hold the same opinion. But if you send something that expresses the truth about you, that says it from your perspective, you say, you know, I am an entrepreneur using free software, and I'm very worried that free software will become much harder to develop if the digital economy bill is allowed to fall into the hands of the BPI. Mm. Or you can say, I'm a student, and I'm very worried that that the actions of the people around me in my hall are going to make my university hall be cut off the internet, and that's just not fair. Mm. Say how it is for you, say it succinctly, and you'll have a far bigger impact on your MP.
Now, you implied there that the digital economy bill stuff was linked to ACTA, this sort of trade agreement, international. What impact will that have on everybody else? We've got listeners outside the UK as well. What sort of impact will ACTA have on them?
Well, to give a little bit of background on ACTA, ACTA stands for the Anti-Counterfeiting Trade Agreement. It was started a number of years ago as a privately negotiated trade agreement outside the scope of the World Trade Organization or the World Intellectual Property Organization, WTO and WIPO. The reason it's outside the scope of those organizations is the big, powerful governments had noticed that third world governments now had a voice at WIPO and WTO, and they felt they wouldn't be able to steamroller through rigorous, regressive rules about the handling of digital media and about trademark counterfeiting and a number of other things. They were worried that, for example, these third world countries would say, we need generic drugs as fast as possible. Our people are dying of AIDS, yeah. So no, we won't sign up for a drug counterfeiting treaty. Mm-hmm. So what they did was they created a new venue to negotiate this treaty. It's a secret venue, so you only get to be a member of the club. It's just like Fight Club. You know, the first rule is you don't talk about ACTA. And it's taken 3 years for us to get a full leak of the draft document. It came out about 2 weeks ago. You'll find it. It's actually up on Pirate Bay if you want to go there, or you'll find it in a number of other places. And what this treaty does is it gathers together a bag of all of the rules around patents, trademarks, copyright, all those things that are deceptively called intellectual property.
Things like counterfeiting handbags.
So it's all about making sure that Louis Vuitton handbags are really Louis Vuitton handbags.
Right.
It's all about making sure that when you buy a copy of Michael Jackson's DVD, it was that the royalties go to the copyright holder of Michael Jackson's DVD. The chapter that's about internet things is just a subsidiary part. And much of what ACTA talks about is actually fair enough. Mm. You know, it's fair enough that people who are making bulk rip-off products shouldn't be allowed to import them into countries pretending they're the real thing and possibly endangering people's life and health.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's fair enough to enforce all... You know, the reason we have trademarks is because trademarks give you confidence that the thing is real.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of good stuff in there. However, whenever you create a secret venue like this and then invite people with a vested interest, if you don't invite all the vested interests, what will happen is the agenda will gradually skew further and further and further in the direction of the interests that are represented. Mm. And ACTA has become very skewed indeed in the direction of rights holders, both digital and pharmaceutical rights holders. And so there are two important groups of people who think that it's a big problem having ACTA waved through. One of them are people who are concerned about third world pharmaceuticals. And want to allow generic drugs to be made as soon as possible so that lives can be saved in third world countries that can't afford to pay high royalty fees. And the second group of people are people who are interested in digital freedom. for people who believe that if you are regressive about access to knowledge, access to the internet and access to technology, that we won't see the innovation that has driven the amazing pace of the 21st century into being able to be sustained.
What kind of restrictions are we talking about here? The same kind of things that are in the digital economy bill, or
The first problem you have in talking about this, of course, is that because it's been secret for so long, most of what we know about it has been based on speculation. Mm. And it's only been in the last 2 weeks that we've actually seen the draft bill. When you look at the draft bill, you discover that there is very little agreement amongst even the negotiators at the moment about how it should be and what the clauses should be. So the problem areas in ACTA are there is a problem area around putting the responsibility for what's on networks into the hands of internet service providers. So internet service providers will become responsible for the things that are on their networks. And the result of making them responsible for what's on their networks will be that they will have to start filtering. They will have to put in place controls over who can have access. Because if they don't have those controls in place, they will then become liable for the misbehavior that happens on their networks. It's what I term an erosion of common carrier status. So that's one of the aspects. There's actually a really good summary of ACTA up on the website for La Quadrature du Net. La Quadrature du Net is a digital liberties organization based in France, and they have a great three-clause summary for ACTA. The really big problem with ACTA is that all the things that it does have been tried before in other legislatures and have been kicked out.
Right.
So one of the things that's in there is the criminalization of trademark and copyright infringement.
Okay.
So at the moment it's a civil matter. You can get sued and fined.
Right.
But ACTA wants to see it become a criminal matter so that you can be imprisoned for breaching copyright and breaching patent rights and breaching trademarks. And now that was a part of the European Union's a bill in the European Union called IP Red 2, the intellectual property, I can't remember what it stands for. IP Red 2, which was around about 2 years ago, 2007, and got suspended by the European Parliament because it was far, far too extreme.
Right.
Well, what's happened is the European negotiators in these secret negotiations have been pushing all of these rejected clauses of IP Red 2 into ACTA. And then what's going to happen is when the negotiations at ACTA are finished, there'll be this finished 50-page treaty, and national governments will be given a binary decision. Do you want to adopt it and ratify it, or do you want to reject it and become a pariah who doesn't get any more episodes of House? And you can see legislators looking at this and saying to themselves, well, you know, there's a lot of things in this bill we don't like because we didn't like them the first time they came around. Mm. But if we reject it, our citizens won't vote for us next time. So, well, we better adopt it, hadn't we?
But it only works if lots of people adopt it. I mean, there's certain key players. If they didn't adopt it, it wouldn't be a valid proposition.
That's true. Unfortunately, the keyest of the key players are the people whose governments are pushing ACTA.
Right. So
they are the UK. Actually, not the UK. They are the European Commission.
Right.
They are the European, the United States Trade Representative.
Right.
And a couple of others. The best chance we have with ACTA, though, is for the European Parliament to decide that what's going on is disgraceful. So while any one government will find themselves unable to say no to ratifying ACTA, a block of, say, 26 countries is going to find it something that where they can unite together and say, no, we don't like it.
Right.
Now, it just so happens the European Parliament are not very happy about the European Commission engaging in secret negotiations without involving them.
Yeah.
There was if you're a sad watcher of European legislation like I am, you'd have seen a thing go through the European Parliament recently on the SWIFT agreement. SWIFT is how banks transfer money backwards and forwards across international boundaries.
Right.
And SWIFT 3 required an international treaty that was going to let the Americans see all of our bank transactions over here in the UK. And the European Commission had said, look, it's just what we've got to do if we want to be modern guys.
Mm.
And the European Parliament said, by no means, and voted SWIFT 3 down by a 2-1 vote in the European Parliament. And so we know the European Parliament doesn't like secret negotiations. It does not like fait accompli. It does not like the European Commission negotiating things that they've been told not to. And so a really valuable action that listeners throughout Europe can take is to write to their MEP and say that they think that ACTA needs to be brought into the full glare of daylight.
Right. Mm.
And we can ask our MEPs to sign up for a written declaration that's on the table in the European Parliament at the moment that sets parameters by which ACTA will be acceptable.
And is there a deadline for our MEPs to sign that?
Or? Yeah, it's coming up really soon. So if you're listening now, after if you're in the UK, the first thing that you want to do is send a letter to your MP about the Digital Economy Bill. If you're not in the UK, the first thing you want to do is write to your MEP about the written declaration about ACTA, which is on the table in the European Parliament. And unfortunately, writing to your MEP if you're outside the UK is a harder job because the writetothem.com doesn't cover people who are outside the UK.
But it does cover those who are in the UK and want to write to their MEP.
It does.
As well as their MP.
Yes. Right. So okay. writetothem.com will let you write to your local councillor. It will let you write to your MP. It will let you write to your MEP.
And are there other organisations that we should be supporting who are active in this area?
Yes. So in the UK, we've got the Open Rights Group. The Open Rights Group is running campaigns on each of the three things that we've been talking about this evening. Mm-hmm. If you're in France, like Quadrature du Net is a good thing to support. You can get information about ACTA from two really good sources. There's an organization called Knowledge Ecology International, or KEI, and KEI's website has got lots of good information about ACTA. They've been receiving lots of surreptitious leaks recently, and there's been some really good information coming out. There's also a Canadian professor called Michael Geist, who has a truly excellent website about ACTA, that it's well worth adding it to your feed reader so that you can see what he's finding out. And if you look at either of those things, they usually will give pointers to the places where activism is being coordinated. Then finally, there's a thing called the Transatlantic Consumer Dialogue, which is an organization being formed by concerned politicians in Europe. It's been set up in particular by David Hammerstein, who was a Spanish MEP in the last parliament. And he has got lots of good insider information and pointers about what's going on.
Fantastic.
Excellent. One final thing is that you're coming to talk at Og Camp, I understand.
I've heard that rumour.
Please tell me it's true, because we've been
telling
people
rumor.
It is.
It's a true rumour.
We've been telling everyone.
Yeah, I'm planning to come to Og Camp, and we'll see where all this stuff has got to. I will be talking about software freedom and the imperative of protecting software freedom in practical, real terms, rather than worrying about whether we're from the GNUDian People's Front or the People's Front of GNUDia.
That's easy for you to say. And we'll be probably a week away from the general election
Less than that.
It's going to be pretty close. It's by then it will be a great time to be asking your MP really rather pointed questions about why they didn't oppose the Digital Economy Bill. I should be more positive, shouldn't I? asking them how they feel about the Digital Economy Bill being put on ice.
Yes, and presumably the candidates as well, not just the incumbents.
I wrote to my Conservative and my Lib Dem candidate for my constituency this afternoon, asking them what their view was on the Digital Economy Bill. One of the big problems with the Digital Economy Bill is it's going into wash-up in Parliament. You know, it could be blocked by the Conservatives and the Lib Dems if their front bench spokespeople had any balls. But unfortunately, particularly in the Lib Dems, you know, you see that it's actually the conference that has the balls, and the front bench spokesmen don't think that the Digital Economy Bill matters very much.
So just to wrap up, what are you going to be doing with your time then, now that you're signing on every couple of weeks but contributing to the running of the OSI?
I've got a blog that I'm writing on every day. Doing open source consulting. I'm very interested in making sure that OSI has a positive future that promotes software freedom for all of us. I'm very interested in, as long as politicians remember what I used to do for a living, going and trying to use that influence to change things over in Brussels and in Parliament. And I'm also going to be growing vegetables. That's
excellent.
One thing I'll be doing as the spring comes on.
And you're a bit of a photographer as well, is that
I have been known to take photographs. I sell my photographs, in actual fact. So I need to take some new ones as spring is coming on now. And I listen to music a lot. So I put up free music picks every Sunday up on my blog.
All right, excellent.
Cool.
Well, thank you very much indeed for coming along and talking to us. I suspect we could talk for another hour yet, but, you know.
Over beer in Liverpool, maybe.
Yes, that absolutely. Well, we'll see you in Ockham then.
Absolutely.
Thanks very much. We've got some command line love, haven't we, Simon?
Yeah. Ooh. Something slightly different. Oh, we may have to rename the segment.
To Gerald?
No. There's a script for that.
Ah.
It's like that. We thought about that in the pub
whilst drinking, clearly.
Whilst preparing for the show.
I was only drinking cake, whilst doing show prep. Right, I don't wait for Ubuntu to tell me when the packages need updating.
Right.
You sit there and repeatedly run apt-get update.
Well, I don't. I use aptitude, so I do sudo aptitude update and sudo aptitude dist upgrade.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
That takes a long time. So I thought, well, hang on a minute. Why not just put that into a little script? And so I type one short word, which I use sort. So S-O-R-T. I type in sort, enter, and it just does all that stuff. Enter password, and it cracks on. So that's it. It's nothing spectacular, but it's very, very simple. And that's, of course, what script should be about, making things easier.
So it automatically applies all the updates. Yeah, you know, not just downloads them, it applies them to the system.
Absolutely.
Okay. What happens if there's a question? Because sometimes
basically,
a package
when it gets
will
to the question,
a question.
It'll sit there and wait for you to answer the question.
Okay. All right.
So all the script does, and it's not really a script, it's just a quick way
concatenation of two commands.
Indeed. But I type four characters, enter, done, instead of, you know, 20.
You're so lazy.
But it's a quick and easy way into scripts. So we'll put it on the site, and hopefully you can all have a play with it and get back to us and tell us what you think.
And if you break your system, don't blame Simon.
Yeah, and if the command that Simon has created called sort conflicts with an internal command called sort on your system, then
Well, you call it whatever you like.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I've not got into the details of where you should put it, where you might want to put it. Maybe we'll cover that some other time.
Cool.
It's time for the...
Gerald.
I nearly swore. Time for the bit about Ubuntu, and the first item is URL to follow. Alan, can you explain this some more?
No. Right. I didn't want to put that.
Oh, okay.
You don't want to say that. You don't want to say that. That's just, I don't have the URL to put in
there. Ah, I see what you've done there. Okay. So it's about the Ubuntu Manual project, which is after help getting screenshots of Ubuntu Lucid before 10.04 is released.
Yeah, Benjamin Humphreys has... steered a project, the Ubuntu Manual project, to create a PDF, printable PDF, for beginners. And one of the things they need to do is get loads of screenshots, but they can't do that until the GUI has been finalized. And then they've got a huge amount of screenshots to take in...
Not very much time.
Not much time, right. In lots of different languages.
Ah, of course.
They're localizing it, yeah.
Wow. They want to talk to Anna Nelson.
Really?
Yes. And her documents, automated documentation project... Mm-hmm. It hooks the docs into the build process so that it automatically generates updated screenshots every time there's a build.
Oh,
or
wow.
However often you run it.
Wow.
Looks fantastic. She used it for her thesis and she presented about it at Osbar camp last September.
She also talked a bit about it in the interview we did outside the toilets at a pub in
I remember that.
What they've done is they've created an application called QuickShot and they've respun the Ubuntu CD.
Mm-hmm.
So that people who want to contribute can boot from this live CD and go through and take all these screenshots using this QuickShot tool that takes all the right screenshots of the right size and does all that kind of stuff.
Oh, cool.
That's pretty
good as well.
Yeah, looks quite neat.
So we're going to stick a link in the show notes if people are willing to get involved?
Yes, absolutely.
Excellent.
David Siegel blogged about removing more buttons from GNOME.
Yeah, it's got too many as it is.
Some people think that we're going too far with GNOME and making it too simple and, you know, dumbing down a bit.
One of the things people do say is that, you know, if the ideal GNOME desktop would be one big button that said, do this and make everything work for me.
Yes.
And that sounds good to me. Seriously, if it did what I wanted.
Yeah, right. But what do you want? What do you want?
Nah, well, let's not get into this again. Yeah, at least we've got Laura on a microphone before we start trying fumble around user
my
interface.
Idea of usability
say,
is...
if you're happy to spend that long making your desktop look sexy from Debian... then you're happy enough to spend the time going from a really simple Ubuntu into a more horrible Ubuntu to whatever suits you. So I don't see why anybody ever complains because they always have to customize.
Yeah. In this particular example, he's talking about removing some duplicated or redundant parts of the GNOME file browser.
It does look clean. The second screenshot on his blog post is really nice.
The idea being to free up more space for actual, you know, content.
Although it actually looks like the window manager has crashed and gone away.
And it's lost the title bar.
Yeah.
Yeah, and to be fair...
It is a mock-up, isn't it?
Well, it's either a mock-up, but the window decoration is different anyway, so...
Yes.
The content is different, but also the decorations are different, which they wouldn't necessarily be. But it does look nicer. I mean, as you say, there's more space for content and less duplication of things. But yeah, we'll put a link to that again in the show notes where you can find out more about that little tweak. Do you know if that's going to be making its way into Lucid?
No.
So that'll be...
Is that no you don't know?
Partly because it says there, I am using GNOME Global Menu, and that's definitely not going to be in Lucid.
Right, okay. Ah, right, yes, of course. The one that appears at the top.
OS X menu.
Yeah, allegedly. Okie doke, what's up next?
Steve Kemp blogged about... well, it's quite a long blog post, and I'm not quite certain how to summarise it. But it's basically about everybody arguing constantly, I think.
It's partly that, but it's partly also about the types of people who are now joining in the argument.
Mm.
Whereas previously it might have been a heated debate between two developers about what's the right strategy for resolving a bug. Now it's a load of non-developers, possibly non-contributors, jumping in and saying, well, I think the buttons should be over here, and no, the bike shed should be blue. And and that's partly a byproduct of Ubuntu being popular.
Successful.
Yeah.
So this might be people who don't use Ubuntu or just...
No, people who use Ubuntu and feel passionate about
it being a good usable system.
Yeah, and maybe...
Should they not be able to say what they think?
I'm not saying they shouldn't.
Okay.
No. I'm just saying there are more of them now than there were before.
I'll say no. They shouldn't.
Why?
Well, no, they should.
Well, we encourage them to, and we tell them they can't use it unless they report bugs, and then we tell them they can't report bugs because they're only users.
Okay, I almost blogged about this, but my passion went away from it, but this might get it back again. Everybody has to understand where they sit. No, we're all users.
This is reminding me of a certain sketch. I look up to him and I look down to him.
Yeah, okay, my place. Take the mickey, but it's absolutely true. And to be perfectly honest, that's what Mark Shuttleworth said at the end. Great, you can sit there and you can all debate, but at the end of the day, somebody's going to make a decision. If you don't like it, then you have to accept it because the decision has been made.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I agree with that, but I don't necessarily agree that... I don't agree with what Laura said. I don't think that you shouldn't have your say. Yes, you can have your say. But
I didn't say that.
No. But you implied you were asking
the attitude,
and I don't. I think that people should have their say, but I don't think they should necessarily turn a bug report into a mailing list post or a forum. It's a bug report, not a method of discussion.
But then that's not a culture that if they're just users, they're not going to be used to bug reports and things.
Oh, absolutely. Bit of education there, and that actually leads on to the next one of our items,
yes.
Which is that Mark Shuttleworth has posted on one of the celebrity bug reports.
Oh, that one, okay.
Yeah, 532633.
You know that one.
Yeah. It's about the buttons.
Put it tattooed on my knuckles.
about asking people to just calm down because the bug has gone crazy and lots of people have commented with their opinion of the buttons. And
so is it about time that he or the community sort of managed everybody's expectations? And it comes back to what I said about understanding where you sit. Everybody has the right and absolutely should be able to voice their opinion. But because you can voice your opinion doesn't mean you're going to actually have any effect. And if nobody listens to you or nobody comments, you shouldn't go off in a rage.
Well, there's no reason for going off in a rage on a bug report in any way.
Really?
Well, in an ideal world, no.
I agree. It's great that people are that passionate about Ubuntu, but they should realise that they may not actually be able to change the world.
Well, never mind all this what side of the button's on. Let's get down to the really important Ubuntu story of the last couple of weeks. I think the thing that will shake the distribution to its very core. And this is that the default units are going to be changing in 10.10 from the IEC standard of base 2 units for file sizes to the System International SI standard of base 10 units.
Oh, really?
Yes. What do you mean? Why that voice? I don't understand.
Because it's incredibly nerdy and your average user doesn't care. All they care is that the disk I bought is 500 megabytes, but it doesn't look like 500 megabytes. Yeah. It looks like 450 or something.
Yeah, exactly. Where's that 50 megabytes gone? Well, this will tell you. Basically, they're going from the technically correct but represented confusingly KIB system, you know, where you've got little I's in between.
Kibibytes.
To the kilobytes being 1,000 bytes. Mm-hmm. It will be an option for those who, you know, feel the hatred for hard drive manufacturers who don't print their stats properly. You can switch to the full IEC standard if mm-hmm. you really want to.
But that's not in Lucid. This is changing.
No, this is in 10.10.
It's a proposal.
That
it may be changed later.
Yes.
So other operating systems do things differently.
Absolutely. And wrongly.
Did somebody say Dumbuntu?
Oh.
Well, if that's the case, then you go to Nautilus, click on a disk, and it should say about 500 gig, about half a terabyte.
I'd like that.
Well, Dave always
that's
says
like he, fuzzy clock.
Yeah,
isn't
Dave
it?
Always says he misses the fuzzy clock from KDE when it, because the fuzzy clock says, oh, it's afternoon, or you know, it's about lunchtime.
It's after two.
Yeah. That might explain why he hasn't arrived yet for the recording. And that's all in the bit about Ubuntu this time. Time for your feedback. We've had a lot this time around. We do read it all, but please, the shorter the message, the more likely it is to be read out. So let's get it over and done with. Let's do the buttons first.
Get it over and done. Oh, I see. Yes. I thought you meant the feedback over and done with.
I meant quite specifically the button-related feedback. Obviously, we've interviewed Ivanka in the last episode, and JM Peng wrote in to say,
I loved your interview with Ivanka Magic. As a member of the Macfarlane development team, as a docs writer, I knew about the debate on which side the buttons should be on. I have them on the right because I think the buttons are more readily accessible there. But I also loved hearing about why the 100 Paper Cuts project was started. The Ubuntu UK podcast is the best podcast I've ever heard.
This Excellent. Is true, yes.
We didn't put that in. No.
Thanks
for giving me such a great way to keep informed about what's going on with my distro.
Well, thank you for that. That's a really nice comment, isn't it?
Yeah. Very kind.
We should appreciate that.
Soren left us a series of messages on the website, but the main point was,
I think having the buttons on the left is brilliant. I know it's really annoying to get used to it, but once you do, you realise that most of your activity in a window is concentrated toward the upper left corner anyway. So having the buttons on the right is a really bad idea, since you always have to move away from where you concentrate your mouse movements to minimise or close a window.
I don't think we should get into that discussion.
That's interesting.
Keyboard shortcuts for the win.
Yeah.
Okay, one word answer. One word answer, left or right?
Don't mind.
Ambivalent.
Danke.
No, neither do I.
Notice the two of us failed to give one word answers.
Yeah.
Only Laura's the clever one over there who managed to come up with ambivalent.
Yeah, there's well a bit of pressure there. Yeah.
Andy Piper piped up on our website.
Nice. I'm sure again. He's going to love that.
Yeah, because taking the mickey is just...
Ubuntu, and GNOME specifically, has been heading towards a Mac look for a long time. No. There are many nods to the direct copies of OS X user interface. I see this being a GNOME design trend as much as an Ubuntu and Canonical one.
Oh, that's interesting. Hmm. Yes. We have some feedback basically saying that they disagreed with Ivanka's opinion that Ubuntu isn't heading down a Mac OS X look and feel type route.
In fact, a few people have commented on that celebrity bug report that, why can't you see it? Are you blind? Are you stupid? Can't you see it? You're turning into OS X. It's like, are we?
Oh, so?
Are
we?
Okay, fair enough. After our voicemail we had last time, or just a moment, Hannah P. tells us that Ubuntu is even boyfriend friendly.
My boyfriend who hates the command line has been quite happy using Ubuntu for 3 years now, and I think he's used command line once when I forced him to. Unfortunately, Ubuntu is a bit too straightforward for my lady brains, so I'm using one of its offspring, Crunchbang.
Lady brains.
I keep Simon happy. You're a Crunchbang.
Oh, I haven't used Crunchbang for a long time.
Yeah. Although
it's too much for his lady brains.
There's been a big change with Crunchbang.
Yeah, it's switched to Debian, hasn't it?
Yeah, it's gone to Debian.
Right.
Mm. We'll have words with Phil at OGCamp.
Oh, yeah.
That's a good interview to set up, isn't it?
Yeah. Okay, Mark Johnson commented on our website that...
Further to the command line, love. If you accidentally type a command that you meant to run as root without sudo in front of it, you can then rerun it as root by typing sudo !!!
Brilliant tip. Ooh. I used that yesterday.
Really?
Yeah.
Wicked.
It works. It's cool.
Well, what you should do is just not forget to put sudo in front of it in the first place. Or switch to root and run everything as root.
That's a good idea.
No, it isn't, actually. Please don't anybody do that.
Why not? It's a great idea.
No.
Run your entire desktop as root.
Pendulum pointed out that you could have come away with the impression that the EPUB ebook format was always protected by DRM.
Yeah, Tony.
Tony.
Thanks.
And that isn't the case, and there are non-DRM'd EPUB books out there.
Yeah,
there are. And I knew that because I have downloaded them and tried them with the Cooler book, but it was not explicitly clear within the context of the review that that is the case. So definitely, you can get non-DRM'd EPUB books, but not, you know, good ones.
I think we've got that now.
Yes. Clear as mud. Last time round, we asked why some people listen to the show but don't use Ubuntu, and Ross Anderson replied to say,
if sounds don't work, printers don't work, wireless doesn't work, etc., you will never get mass acceptance of Ubuntu. It's just not as simple to use as Windows, even though it is better, faster, more stable, safer, etc. I do know about the Software Center, Synaptic, and what is so wrong with Googling something and clicking on the download button and then expecting it to work. I suggest you buy a brand new laptop and get somebody who already uses a Windows box and is not a geek and challenge them to put a copy of Ubuntu 9.10 from the web, install the software, use a webcam, print a picture and play an MP3 file without help from you guys.
I'm not sure what the value of that challenge is. Yeah, I can see. Right. I can see how you could go through that as a test to say whether it's easy to download Ubuntu, whether it's easy to set up a webcam, as a set of individual steps.
Hmm.
But who does that? Most people who are introduced to Ubuntu get it on a Linux magazine, or they get given it to them, or they hear about it somewhere. I don't know.
I understand. He's basically saying if it's as simple as we all suggest that it is, it should work.
Yeah.
But the fact is, I don't use Mac. But when I walk into the Mac shop, it takes me time to find out what everything is, how it works, every single time I go back in there. So, you know, that's just using a new OS.
My mum, last week, on her very first time using a computer, played Solitaire.
This is Mumbuntu.
Mumbuntu. Played Solitaire. The very next time she was using Ubuntu, she was cropping images and removing red eye from photos.
Wow.
And those are only the two times she's ever used a computer.
That's brilliant. As for Googling something and clicking on the download link and expecting it to work, would you do that with Windows?
Yes, you would. But that's the bad practice you get from Windows.
No. That was more just the point that the people he's talking about wouldn't do that.
Wouldn't do what?
Wouldn't install Windows on a laptop.
We're talking about how we reckon Ubuntu is so much easier because we have Synaptic and the Software Center. Yeah. And he's saying Windows users will generally just Google for an application, find a download link, click it, and what we generally advocate is you don't do that on Ubuntu because we've got this Software Center and you know, you get updates and all that kind of malarkey. And what's so bad about clicking on a link on a website?
Well, in fact, anybody could produce it and it could have anything in it.
Yeah, but Windows users have been doing that for years.
Yeah.
So it's no different for them that clicking on a piece of malware for Windows as opposed to clicking on a piece of malware on Ubuntu.
Or just not very well-produced ware.
Just that there isn't much of that.
Right, yeah, I suppose so.
We also heard on the subject of people who listen to the show but say they'll never use Ubuntu from, oh crikey, I can't pronounce that name.
Mani Merak.
Thank you.
I also like the podcast and will never use Ubuntu, but just because I like my cutting-edge Arch Linux system and KDE better. Never had any luck with Kubuntu. The cast comes off as way more mature than the other open-source Linux podcast I've tried listening to, and I've listened to a lot of rubbish out there.
Nicely edited there.
Yeah. Just call me an old bloke.
An old bloke.
That's very kind of you to say. Thank you very much.
It's very nice. Thank you for the comment.
And finally, Zan Gornak from Slovenia emailed,
I've started listening to the podcast a week ago, and I've listened to almost all episodes while working on my website. Weirdly enough, I've listened to the episodes in reverse order, from newest to oldest.
God, that was painful.
I've no idea why. In the past, I used to play...
I don't think I had a compliment there.
Not sure we can help you with that. In the past, I used to play many games, and that used to be the only reason why I didn't use Linux full-time. But now that I only listen to music and write code, I'm planning on switching to Ubuntu 10.04 full-time when it's released in April. P.S. I've attached a sound file with me saying my name, because I noticed you had problems pronouncing some strange names.
I hope I got it right then. So, thank you very much for that email from...
Shan.
Which I've just pronounced perfectly. And that's all your feedback. Thanks for listening. It was a good show, I thought.
Yeah.
Really interesting interview.
Yeah, I'm inspired to write back to my MP now.
Yeah, you better get on with it. We're giving some homework to do. Mm. I just want to mention a quick congratulations to Selexius on the IRC channel for spotting what was new in the last episode.
Nobody here has noticed.
Was it something, an audio thing?
Yeah. You said you were going to put a new piece of music in. I can't remember what the name is.
Yeah.
Bed?
A new sting.
Sting.
A new sting appeared. Nobody here noticed it. Anyway, you can find out how to get in touch with us on our website at podcast.ubuntu-uk.org, where we've got our voicemail number, Twitter, our Identica feeds, IRC channel, and a whole load of other stuff on there.
Thanks for listening.
See you next time.
See you in a couple of weeks.
Bye.
Bye.